1001 Albums podcast. Today my guest is Robert Dimery, the general editor of the 1001 Albums You Must Hear Before You Die book, and today we'll be talking about the book in general, plus also David Crosby's If I Could Only Remember My Name. Wonderful. So welcome to 1001 Albums. The author, do you call it the author or is general editor, I think you call it, isn't it? Rob Dimery, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, thanks, James. Yes, I was the general editor on 1001 Albums, the first edition of which came out way back in 2005, I think. Wow. And so I had a really amazing collection of writers who provided material for the book. And I oversaw the whole process. I edited pretty much all of them. Right towards the end, it was a bit of a tight squeeze to meet the deadline. So I had to call on two very good friends of mine, Bruno MacDonald, who's written a few books in his time as well. Chris Bryans, and they helped me out with finishing it off, the original 2005 edition. Mm-hmm. And I wrote a few entries myself as well, which we may touch upon later on.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, that's the story. It seems like a long 15 years ago for the first edition of that book.
Wow. And I mean, taking it back a little bit further, Rob, whereabouts did you grow up, and was music a big part of your life growing up?
Yeah, it was massive. I grew up in Cheltenham, and my mum was, or still is, she's still with us, a very gifted pianist, and she used to teach music as well. So I think it was in the blood anyway. And then, you know, I followed quite a well-worn path, really. Started off in school bands when I was about, 14 or 15, then went to art college, formed another band there. And it never left me, really. And then I've sort of through a circuitous route of sort of, you know, getting, I was in a band called Rosemary's Children. Deal with Cherry Red Records for a period, and after that I suppose when we left the label, I thought, well, I should get myself a proper job or something. So I went off and got myself a degree, and ended up in editing, just because I love books and I love music, and fortunately in 1001 Albums the two sort of met.
Yeah, perfect.
And it opened the door for me in a lot of ways, because it's led to me doing more editing and writing of books as well, which has been lovely. I just written a book on cult musicians, which is I think it's out now, 50 cult musicians. And I've got a biography of David Bowie, which I wrote, which was amazingly enjoyable. And that's due out early next year as well.
Great, that's fantastic. So what sort of musically, when you were sort of, a young teenager or later teens, that's when most people like really start to get into music. Was that the case for you? And was what sort of music really turned you on to that new world?
I would say that I was quite puritanical as a youth. And when I first, in fact, when I was, just to go back a bit before that, when I was, I would imagine about 10 or so, maybe a bit younger than that, punk was sort of happening. And my mate, and I, before punk, I'd really liked the Beatles, you know, hearing them on the radio and what have you. And I remember a friend of mine who was a bit, maybe a year or two older than me, he was bringing to my attention things like the Pistols albums and, you know, New Waves, The Clash, you know, New Wave stuff as well. And I felt so, I couldn't kind of hold the two concepts in my head of the Beatles and the kind of the sound world that they represented and everything they represented in terms of an attitude to life, and the Pistols. And I liked both of them, but I couldn't quite hold the two of them in my head. I remember I used to keep their records stacked in separate piles because I thought they shouldn't really meet. I was very, as I say, very puritanical, maybe a bit OCD. And then, but when I started, you know, just discovering the rudiments of how you make music yourself as a teenager, learning guitar, and that was a real struggle. I remember just willing my fingers to make the shapes I wanted them to, and they wouldn't. But I got very quickly, I got into, oh, I don't know, I think the Paisley Underground movement of the mid-80s, mid-late 80s was happening at the time with bands like the Rain Parade and what have you. And I kind of worked back through them to the source, if you like, of people like the Byrds who just made a massive impact on me, the Byrds, as they did for so many people around that period, you know, not just in terms of that jingly jangly guitar sound, the Rickenbacker sound that they kind of made their own, but just their songwriting and the harmonies as well. The harmonies were just, I just thought, how do you even do that? You know, I tried to do work into the bands I was in at the time. Crimson flames tied through my ears, flowing high and mighty trap. Countless fire and flaming road, using ideas as my map. We'll meet on edges soon, said I. Proud, knee-deeded brow. Ah, but I was so much older then. I'm younger than that now. So it would definitely have been them. Obviously, people like the Smiths, who kind of had a little bit of that, excuse me, that sound about them, but also they just had that. This is jumping ahead a little bit, but for me, the best bands and indeed the best albums, they suggest a whole new way of a whole new way of being to you. Like they're another world.
Got you.
They're showing you what their world looks and sounds and feels like. And the Smiths obviously conjure up a very particular world. It's the North. It's Morrissey's sort of erudition. It's the brilliance of Johnny Marr's guitar playing and arrangements. And it's that really for them, for me rather, that one of their great strengths was that when you listen to people have this idea rather in their heads that the Smiths are quite downbeat and dour, but you set that a lot of that's Morrissey's intonation, I think. A lot of that's Morrissey's, not just his lyrics, but also his intonation. You set that against the music, which more often than not is just sparkling. They're so alive, you know, the Smiths' music. And I think that's something that I cherish about the albums that I love personally, you know, that they open up a whole sound world for you that and invite you in, and sometimes it chimes with something you feel yourself, and sometimes it's completely foreign to you, something you wouldn't have even considered, but it just it's exhilarating. Punctured bicycle on a hillside desolate.
I think that's what the book celebrates for me, is the album, you know, that this specific thing, you know, it's not about singles, it's not about compilations, it's not about bands, it's about albums, whether it's 30 minutes, 40, 50, 60, 70 minutes, but this one-off kind of piece of artwork, you know, and that to me is such a beautiful kind of thing. You know, a feature film works well about 90 minutes, you know, an album works well. Obviously we start off with kind of the limitations of a piece of vinyl that it tended to be around about what, 40 odd minutes. But yeah, I mean, there is just something perfect about that sort of that period of time. And even the way that, you know, the albums, even now that most people don't listen to albums on vinyl, I still can't help but think, okay, well, that's kind of the end of side one, you know, that still sits in my head as well. I mean, was that important to you, thinking about the album as in its place in history when we were coming into a new decade, obviously when you were writing this book, where the album as a thing was kind of, you know, being sidelined by this new thing that came and just, you know, destroyed everything in its path, aka the internet?
Yeah, yes, I think so. I think there was a kind of a taking stock feel about the whole project that it's difficult because, you know, if you're of a certain age and you did grow up with vinyl albums, then you sound like a bit of an old fuddy-duddy saying how perfect they were. But you're right, as a form, it's a bit like, I mean, you use the analogy of a movie there. It's a bit like the difference between a novel and a short story, I think, as well, for me, because a single can be a wonderful short story. If I think about something like, and this is another band that meant a lot to me at the time when I was first getting to grips with being in bands, the Jesus and Mary Chain, their debut single Upside Down, it's almost like a perfect statement of what the Jesus and Mary Chain are all about. You, in a way, you almost don't need the Jesus and Mary Chain's albums, because if you want to know why they were important, that, I don't know how long it is, 2 or 3 minute long song, that tells you everything. And you know, at the end of it, I remember hearing it because my mates were very into it, and they sort of, you know, somebody gave me a copy and I listened to it and I thought, I don't even know if I like this, but I need to play it again. And it, you know, it makes a very, 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 very incisive, quick impression on you. And you, it does open up a sound world, if you like. And when I hit the ground, I heard the rain sound. I heard the rain sound. And when I hit the ground, inside I'm upside down. And you could say the same about something like the Sex Pistols album, Never Mind the Bollocks. You could say, well, you know, that pretty much tells you everything you need to know about the Sex Pistols. You don't really need to go any... I mean, they didn't release any more.
They didn't, yeah.
that's another good reason. But that sums up what they are all about in a very succinct way. Mm. But with the albums we covered in the book more generally... they just give you, the form of an album gives you scope to really stretch out as an artist. And it's an interesting point as to whether the audience has continued to go with artists along that path since the advent of the internet and streaming. And because for an artist, I think there's still, and I'm speaking very generally, I think there's still a great attraction in the idea of having, I don't know, the best part of how long is an album these days? I suppose it can be as long as you want it to be. A stretch of time to be able to tell, you know, just to sort of express yourself in as fully as you like, as absolutely as fully as you like. Now, it's a moot point as to whether the audience is still as in love with the album as the artists are, clearly, because artists are continuing to put out albums, you know, in the way that they have done since, well, at least 1955 within the Wee Small Hours by Frank Sinatra. There's an attraction. It does work well. It's a bit like, you know, ebooks. Ebooks are around and loads of people use them, but the paperback, people still buy paperbacks. You still see people reading paperbacks all over the place. And there's a reason for that, because that format works really, really well. Mm. It's really handy. It's really portable. It's really light, usually. So the album works in that way very well as well for an artist, you know, and I think that if you're an artist, you've got a terrific kind of blank canvas with an album, and that you can, that I mentioned, sat this idea of a sound world before, and I think it starts with the cover, you know, and this is, again, this is perhaps dating me, but the idea that you would go and buy an album and it would have a cover that would be like your, that's your doorway. That's sure. your doorway into this world that the artist has come up with. And it can be, they can tell you a lot before you even get to the music. And the best album covers, of course, you're kind of looking at them thinking, well, why do they do that? And what's this about? What's that in the corner there? And then, you know, and that's your entree, if you like. And that, you're right, that length that the average album is, you know, as it was in, I don't know, in the 60s, it was about 7 songs a side, I think, usually for pop and rock artists anyway. It just seems very satisfying. Interesting, though, although I do love vinyl, and if I fancy getting something that was released a few years ago and it came out on vinyl originally, then I probably would defer to vinyl. There are some albums that kind of work even better as a CD or as a, or just being streamed, if you like. And I think particularly of something like What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, because that really is a suite of songs. And you don't really want to have to get up in the middle of that and turn the vinyl over and go back and sit down again, listen to the rest. You really do want to experience it as a whole, I think.
I'll tell you something a little bit embarrassing. The first time I heard What's Going On by Marvin Gaye, I was at I knew Marvin Gaye's work. I knew his sort of early 60s sort of poppier stuff. And I was at a party and someone was just playing it in the background. And I said, is this the Marvin Gaye Megamix? Like, because, you know, like Jive Bunny and stuff coming out, Stars and 45. I was like, just the way they almost, because I think I knew Mercy, Mercy Me, I knew What's Going On. I was like, this is just all mushing together. Is the Megamix? It's like, you Philistine, it's What's Going On. I was like, okay, fair enough, sorry.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you cry. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today.
But going back to what you're saying, you mentioned about Frank Sinatra there, and that is that's where the book starts. And I thought that was really interesting. But I mean, it's a shame in a way that you start at that point, because it means you don't get, you know, a lot of the greater earlier artists like, you know, Louis Armstrong and people like that, that, you know, that it feels like they should be in here somewhere. But I suppose you have to start somewhere. And like you were saying, like the book explains it really well, that this album coming as it did with a specific theme. This isn't just like a collection of songs. This is, there's Sinatra on the cover. It is in the Wee Small Hours, and that's exactly what it is. It is his sort of songs of heartbreak, and, you know, and it sort of is encapsulated in that one thing. So was there much debate around that, or was that always a natural place to start?
Well, yes, I mean, it's a bit like what's the first rock and roll song, really? People are going to argue about that until Kingdom Come. I think we had to start somewhere, and obviously the book came out in 2005. So that gave us a neat 50-year span to work with, from 1955 to 2005. So that was one, because obviously you have to, when you're thinking of structuring a book or selling a book, you have to have some, it helps anyway, to have some kind of like a grid or a structure in mind. And I think that 50-year span was very useful for us when we put the book together in the first place. And there's a lot, you're right, I mean, there would have been a host of different records, shall we say, that we could have used at the same time. But there's a lot, it's a hell of a way to start off a book, a Frank Sinatra in the Wee Small Hours, I have to say. I mean, because there is so much in that, that you can, not just his amazing voice, but also that this issue of the fact that there is a theme, there's an ambience that haunts that album, that whole sort of, you know, early morning melancholy reflectiveness that makes it a very powerful opening statement, if you like, I think, for the book. And that's whereas the other records might have been marvelous collections of songs, there's something else going on there with this album. I think there is something that, you know, I mean, I don't know, rock critics, rock writers talk talk a lot of fancy sometimes, and sometimes what they say only really means things to other members of the cognoscenti, I think. And there's, you know, I think it's been, although Sergeant Pepper is widely regarded as, you know, the first concept album, that's been rubbished fairly comprehensively now, I think. And if you just want to look in terms of albums having a whole, a coherence about them, there's some thematic link between everything there, then this, you could call this the first concept album. You know, it keeps you, it holds you in this one particular place for the whole duration of its, you know, 16 songs or whatever it is.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep, you lie awake and think about the girl and never ever think of counting sheep.
All of the above are reasons why, for purely for the 50-year span, but also there are special elements, special things going on with that album that made, we thought, that made it a very successful opening statement for the book.
Mm, no, absolutely. And in terms of the actual putting it together yourself, like how much of it is down to you and how much, or was there a sort of a committee and were you all voting on this? Basically, who do I complain to about the fact that Quadrophenia isn't in there?
Quadrophenia. Well, I'll come back to that, Jane. In terms of the compilation of the thing in the first place, it was, I worked very closely with the art director of the book, who is a massive music fan as well, a guy called Tristan Delancey, who did a beautiful job on designing the book, and who now works at Thames and Hudson, making more beautiful books for them, many music related. So we had being both, you know, massive music fans, we sat down and we drew up a rough list of who we think should be in there. So the bulk of the choice, I would say, is down to me as general editor, and possibly those who know me or know my musical taste would probably be able to tell that, because I do bias in favour of certain artists. I mentioned the Birds earlier, but also people like, I don't know, Radiohead. There's quite a lot of Radiohead in there. There's quite a lot of Bob Dylan in there. And I probably had to hold myself back. Otherwise, I could have been very, very indulgent. Yeah. And you have to think, it's like a tightrope act, really. You're thinking, okay, there's what I want this book to be. And then there's also what the publishers think will appeal to the greatest number of markets in the world. And that sounds a bit sort of, you know, prosaic, but it is a consideration, because at the end of the day, what you're putting out is a labor of love that people have to buy. So there's two different worlds going on there. We wanted to try and put in, as well as a diverse mixture of genres, to try and cover lots of different sort of, you know, music from different countries as well. But there's a lot of things to juggle there. Although mine was the overall deciding factor in voice rather in what went into the book, there was a certain degree of, you know, well, what did Tristan think, and that kind of thing. But it wasn't too difficult. I mean, there weren't a lot of this isn't to say that I would choose exactly the same 1001 albums, obviously, if I were going to do the book again from fresh today. But there was, after a while, you get a feel for what belongs there, if you like. Right. Now, there are things in there that if I did this was 2005 that it came out. If we were to do an anniversary edition of the book, in 5 years' time, I might choose to do a bit of an overhaul, and I might go dig deeper back into the book and take more stuff out, you know. But at the time, I felt that they represented a decent mix between pop and jazz, and between pop, jazz, hip hop, you know, metal, as many different genres as we cram in there, plus a mixture of well-known bands and lesser well-known bands. So it was a sort of, at the end of the day, if you want to send that email in about Quadrophenia, you can send it to me.
Inside, outside,
leave me alone.
Inside, outside,
nowhere is home.
Inside, outside,
where have I been? Out of my brain on the fire. 15. Out of my brain on the train. Out of my brain on the train.
One of the things I thought was interesting, and I've been listening through to, there's another podcast called 1001 Albums Club, and I think I mentioned it to you on email, but there are these guys, it's a bunch of American guys that sort of meet up like a book club, but they're actually going through the book chronologically, and it's lovely, because what I tend to do is listen to the album from the book, and I go and listen to what these guys had to say about it, and it is almost like I'm kind of in their little gang. And one of the distinct things that comes up in that discussion, and also one of the things I've been sort of thinking, is there's various albums that you think, well, why is this in there? And I suppose it's sort of the way I would look at it is you're sort of talking about, because this isn't the 1001 greatest albums, and it's not the 1001 most important albums. It's the 1001 albums you must hear before you die. So were you kind of thinking, well, there needs to be that level of importance and what it meant, whether it was to the future or to that individual scene or a specific stepping stone for an individual artist. But then was there also that consideration of, but the music has to be good as well. Was that, because that's where my head is kind of at with a lot of these. And there's some I think, well, why is that in there? Like, the first Rolling Stones album, for instance, I'm not a fan of at all. I like the later sort of mid-60s to early 70s Stones, I think are great. But the very early sort of bluesy Stones, I can take or leave. And so I sort of think, well, why is this in there? You know, you could knock that one out and get one of the, you know, get another one of their later albums or something. So was it more that kind of combination of importance, you know, sort of versus quality that you were thinking?
I think, well, again, I think it's a bit of a juggling act there too. I think that album, it's very difficult, I think, for us to listen with the ears that people would have had in 1964 to the music of the time. By which I mean, you're right, you could listen to that album now and think, well, so what? I'm sure a lot of other bands were doing things like that. But I think at the time, it was a very kind of individualistic and not particularly commercial prospect statement. And it was, people didn't, you know, you can compare what the Stones were doing on that album to the Beatles. And the Beatles' first album was very fresh and very exciting and obviously had great songs on it. And it was, you know, a new direction and what have you, and very upbeat. And what the Stones were doing by comparison sounds quite, I don't know, quite ragged, quite, you know, ramshackle in some ways, quite punk before its time, you could say. Mm. But that's the point. People weren't doing things like that at the time. People didn't release albums without titles. So, you know, the Stones first album, I'm going to have to quickly look to check that I'm telling you the truth here. I happen to have a copy of 1001 Albums here. That one coming.
It's a good book,
The first Stones album, as far as I remember, there's no title of the band on it, and there's no title of the album, no name of the band and no title of the album. So it's a bit of a bold statement. People didn't, my point is, people, yes, thank God, in 72, they didn't, yeah, people didn't do things like that. That in itself is a statement. That in itself is saying we're doing something that not everybody else is doing here. And it's blues at a time when the blues wasn't, you know, what through people like Eric Clapton it's become, which is sort of like almost so well known, so ubiquitous that it's wallpaper. you don't notice it. You did notice something like that because it was, people looked down on it on the tin at the time. People frowned on it. People thought, well, this is just, you know, this is just a dirty noise. Why would I be interested in this? And they didn't care. I think that's the beauty of an album like that, is that the Stones at that point in their career were still very much doing it because of their love of the music, because they wanted that music, which didn't have a wide audience in this country by then, by any means. They wanted to just show their love and their respect for that kind of stuff. And I think that's why it's in there as much as anything, is that they were doing something that not many other people were doing, you know, and they were doing it. You know, you could carp about Mick Jagger's, I mean, Jack, I was like all artists, I think Mick Jagger kind of grew into himself after a while and he became what we now think of as Mick Jagger. But at the time he wasn't, and he was obviously still finding his voice. And I think it's as a snapshot of a period, as a snapshot of a period when they're just starting out and they're finding themselves, the Stones. I think that alone warrants its inclusion in the book, you know, because they weren't the Beatles. They clearly weren't the Beatles. They weren't trying to be the Beatles. They might have liked the Beatles, you know, but they didn't, and they obviously they became friends, but they didn't want to go down the road that the Beatles were going down. They were doing something that at the time seemed much edgier and far less commercial.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a king, babe. Buzzing around your hive. Well, I'm a king, baby. Buzzing around your hive. Yeah, I can make honey, baby. Let me come inside.
And that, I think, then speaks to the point about importance versus quality. Like, if you were just saying, okay, well, here's 12 songs by, you know, within zero context at all, or 14, however many on that album, then you might go, yeah, that's a decent sort of British Invasion sounding group. Whereas actually, no, it is then, in that instance, it's the, like you were saying, it's all those factors that come into play, I suppose. Yeah, no, it is interesting. I just wanted to pick up on the fact there's been sort of, you know, obviously we've had that sort of period from the 50s and then with this huge explosion of the album in the 60s and 70s. And then you have this tricky thing, because it's not the best albums of the 50s to the 90s, but then we do have to take into account like the modern era. And I've been interested to look at like the different editions and how they've kind of revised it over time, because certain albums have come in and then come out again, you know, in sort of later editions. Now, that's been quite interesting. Yeah. And some of them, I can sort of understand. You've got like the Adele albums have come in and out, Britney Spears, Justin Timberlake, people like this. But also a lot of some of my favorite albums of the last sort of decades, people like Badly Drawn Boy, The Arab Wildebeest, and Zootons. And there's a lot of bands like that came through in that sort of mid-2000s sort of new rock revival kind of thing that then came in and came out again. And I just thought that was interesting to see why certain things had come in and out. And also, you've never gone back and attacked any of the original stuff. So there's certain things from the original, like 1001, I'd say, does that really stand the test of time anymore?
Yeah.
But yeah, you've never taken any of those out, yet you have been willing to chop and change some of the ones that have come in later years.
That's a very good point, James. It's a very good point, very valid point. And there's, without wishing to, you know, pull back the curtain, as they do in The Wizard of Oz, so you can actually see that I'm just a silly old man working away at a machine behind it. There's just a very practical production-related reason for that. And this is why I mentioned earlier that if there were to be a big anniversary edition of the book that we were going to do, and that I had the ability to do this, I would go back and I probably would iron out some of those albums that on reflection I think, well, there's stronger stuff that could replace them. The reason is this, to go through and overhaul the whole of the book would be, well, not the whole of the book, because I think I stand by the majority of the book, but, you know, for those individual albums that I'd like to perhaps, you know, replace with something else, to do that would be prohibitively expensive.
Got you.
Now, that sounds very, again, very prosaic and very, you know, you're not doing it for the love of the music kind of thing. But it is a consideration, because at the end of the day, this is a book that we, that somebody has to pay for to make, and they, it's a bit like releasing an album. You know, they need to get the they need to recoup their recording costs kind of thing. They need to be able to do it as if cost effectively as possible. Now, you can do that. You can do a certain amount of that by just doing the most, the last, I don't know, the last, you know, the books are made up of folios. If you just do the last, I don't know, four or five folios, then that's okay. You can add an injection of new kind of life into the book with new albums, but, and you can afford to do that, and that's fine. If you want to do that for the whole of the book, and you want to take out those albums that you thought, actually, no, that was, that wasn't such a great choice, and replace them with something else, then that becomes prohibitively expensive.
Got you.
So it's the, it's a com, again, it's a compromise, if you like. It's, you can only afford to do a certain amount of things, unless the publisher were to say, oh, come on, let's just, let's make this a real, you know, a celebration, and let's take out the things that we're doubtful about. Let's, from 1982 or 1971 or anything like that, you know, let's really sort of give it complete overhaul, which I'd be very in favor of. I'd love to do that. You know, I'd love to keep the best of it and make it even better.
Sure.
Then that, you know, basically that's the situation. So, I mean, in my defense, I would say that at least we got Badly Drawn Boy and the people that you've mentioned who were only in one or two editions of the book and then were replaced, at least we got them out there in the first
place. Sure.
To tell people, you should go for this, you should go for that. And, like, you know, I'm sure people will only have one edition of this book. You know, some people, I guess, would have bought two or three and will have followed it through. But for most people, one edition, you know, may be enough for them, and they will have the edition with Badly Drawn Boy. They will have the edition with, you know, those other artists who we, with great regret, had to sacrifice. So this brings me to another point related to something you just brought up, which is that if you're going to do a new edition of a book, you're going to want to have new, obviously you have to update it, you have to put new life in there, and you're left with this rather odd situation, because in a sense what I'm saying with this book is these albums are really, really important and they've stood the test of time. How can you say that of an album that's been released a year ago? Because, you know, all I can do in that situation is a best guess. I can look at the situation, I look at the album at the time and think, well, this seems to have worth at the time. I'm going to put this in because musically it's got value to me. It's got something about it. Then the following year, something even better might come along. And then you think, well, when the next edition of the book comes out, probably the first album, you know, that the first time I mentioned, we'll have to lose that, we'll have to put in that other one. So there's like a, the end of the book has this kind of, if you follow the editions through the years, as clearly you have, it has a kind of like a revolving door policy almost. There's things go in and out. You think, well, hang on, that's only been in, it's only been in 2 years and now suddenly it's out and you've got this blooming thing. But that's just the nature of the beast, I'm afraid. When you do a book like that, if you're going to update it, you know, and then David Bowie dies and he does Black Star in 2016, you think, well, that something's got to make way for that. Something's got to make way for that, because that's clearly a major statement in a number of ways, and also was his last album. So, you know, that goes in and something else comes out.
Yeah, no,
so
absolutely.
I'm sorry, that all sounds a bit like I'm saying, you know, I didn't do it for the love of it, or the writers don't do it for the love of it. And that's not true at all. We wouldn't have the book if we didn't love this music in the first place. But I think it's that dark area at the end of the street where, you know, love of music meets commercial necessities, if you like.
God,
and you have to sort of strike some kind of an unholy deal there.
No, absolutely. No, that all makes sense. And yeah, and let's hope that you do get the chance to do it. Or maybe 2001, and then we'll stick another 1,000 in there. How about that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
What are the names and on what streets do they live?
just going to quickly just have a chat about, you know, one of the albums that you really said that meant a lot to you. And I sort of thought, well, I wondered what from this 1001 where you would go. And you've chosen to go for the debut album by David Crosby. Can I just tell us sort of why you picked that one?
Yeah, I can. I mean, in fact, one podcast probably isn't enough to tell you why I picked that one, but I'm going to give it my best shot. So one of the things for me personally that can make an album really extraordinary is a sense of mystery about it. And I would, so for example, for me, when I was growing up in the 80s, REM's first few albums, perhaps especially the first two, were extraordinary because there was a mystery about them, and you didn't quite know what Michael Stipe was singing about. And even if you could hear the words, you didn't quite know what he was singing about because of the way he was using those words, you know? And for me, David Crosby's If I Could Only Remember My Name, which is first solo album. Obviously, he had great success with the Byrds and then with Crosby, Stills and Nash and Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. This is his first solo set. It has mystery in abundance, and it's like any great work of art for me, really, whether it's a painting or a novel or anything. I never feel I can get all the way around it. There's dark corners to it. It's a very it came out of a lot of darkness because he just lost his girlfriend. His girlfriend had died in a car accident, and he was finishing the album Deja Vu by Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young. And he was apparently in tears in the studio. Sometimes you just go in and cry and that would be his day in the studio. You know, he was wrecked. And he finished doing that album, Deja Vu. And he kind of more or less stayed in the studio and just started working on his own thing. Partly, I would imagine, as a cathartic experience to try and work through all of the sadness he was feeling.
Sure.
And he came up with this album, which is... it's an extraordinary album because it's not really, I mean, he had a lot of the cream of the West Coast musicians of the time, like, you know, Jerry Garcia from the Grateful Dead, people from the Jefferson Airplane, Joni Mitchell. And yet it's not really, I mean, a lot of that music can get a bit indulgent after a while, but this isn't an indulgent album. It's a very focused album. It's a real collaborative team effort of an album. And it's got some extraordinary music in, some very, some really sparkling music. He does, there's a song on it called Laughing, which is just, even just talking to you about it now, I'm getting goosebumps. I'm just looking at my arm. It's a wonderful, the acoustic guitars, just, they're really pristine and just zingy and... it's a very, there's a bit of kind of like philosophy in there. There's a bit of where am I in the world? What's happening with my life? Looking for meaning, which is of the time, but also particularly related to him because he just lost the woman he loved and he wasn't expecting. So there's that in there, but it's full of, it's got some very haunting songs in. And I think especially towards the end of the album, you've got some beautiful kind of wordless songs that he did, just him with vocals. I think the last song...
So there's I'd Swear There Was Somebody Here, and then before that you've got Orléans as well.
Yeah, Orléans is beautiful, but there are lyrics with that. So it is telling a kind of a story, I suppose, if you can speak French. It tells a kind of a story. But the last one is just like a howl. It's him stacking. I was listening to a very, if anybody knows this album or if they're intrigued by it and they want to know more about it, there was an interview he did with the BBC a few years ago for their Master Tapes series.
Yeah.
And he talks about just stacking the vocals on that. It's all him stacking the vocals nine deep, like a choir almost. And it just, and he improvised it, and it just goes off in all sorts of weird tangents. It's like having a wind kind of whipping around in your ears when you listen to it. And it's, it's got a real kind of a longing in it. It's like him expressing, I would imagine, what he'd lost and the pain he was going through. And just saying, I'm lost and lonely, you know. But he does it in such a beautiful, beautiful way. And the whole of this album has a focus to it. It just puts you in that. I was talking earlier about, you know, the best albums very often put you in a place, yeah. Give you an ambience. That ambience, despite the fact that there's a great deal of variety in his songwriting through the album, each, you know, you can't really say one song sounds like another. Some of them are more freeform, more jazzy almost. Some of them are more straightforward rock songs. But he holds you from the first note of the first track, which is Music Is Love, right through to I Swear There Was Somebody Here. Mm. He holds you in his place. He takes you on that journey with him. And it's, for me, it's an album I've never been able to get all the way around. I don't completely understand that album, and I almost don't want to. I remember reading somewhere, there was Keith Richards said, there's an Elvis song called You're Right, I'm Left, She's Gone. It's an Elvis song. And Keith Richards loved the guitar song, solo on that by Scotty Moore. And he said, I love it so much, I almost don't want to learn how to play it, because that was a magical way. And I feel the same about this album. There's a point where I think, right, I know enough now. I don't want to know the story behind Cowboy Movie, which is the second track on that album. You know, I just want it to be what it is to me. It's just a very interesting individual statement by this guy who's so talented and who makes such brilliant use of harmony, which is one of the things that makes the Birds magical. It's his high harmony vocal that comes through, that overlays everything, you know? Yeah. And he takes harmonies for a ride here in a really interesting way, in a way that other people didn't. Other people, not just the West Coast, nobody else was doing stuff like this with harmony at the time.
Orléans, Beauchancy, Notre-Dame du Clairé, Vendôme,
you know, and making it so interesting. I mean, you can make a really rotten album with the raw materials that he had to play with. You know, he was depressed, he was sad, you know. And yet he came up with something that's somehow liberating. And you said that the atmosphere in the studio was very, very positive, you know, and you can see that. It's a really rewarding listen. And if your listeners don't know it, I'd, you know, strongly suggest to check it out.
No, absolutely. It was one that was new to me. And I'm really grateful to have been turned onto it, because it's a really interesting piece from start to finish, like you said. And you can just get this vibe of, you know, I'm quite interested in that whole period. And, you know, you sort of have this image of Crosby there, like in Laurel Canyon. And I think he was kind of the sort of the king of the scene, really, wasn't he? That anyone knew coming into, he brought Joni Mitchell in, and anyone knew coming into the scene was like, oh, go and see Crosby. And that was sort of, and you can kind of get this impression of him there at the center of all this different musicians. So like you said, Young's on there, and Nash, and Jerry Garcia and Joni Mitchell, and all these people on there, you know, that really do come to create this really, you know, really interesting piece. I really did pick out Laughing. Absolutely. I thought that was great. And the main thing for me, I mean, I'm not 100% sold on it, because I tend to gravitate towards music where the individual songs are like short, sharp, you know, poppy, great. It's done in 3 minutes, kind of that sort of tends to be my preferred form of song, not the sort of more languid kind of 5-6 minute pieces. But the one thing that really, really sticks out to me on this album is just the playing and the production. Like you said, the guitars sound incredible, and especially listening on a good pair of headphones as well, the stereo mix is remarkable. And you've got the lap steel pedal, which is Jerry Garcia, I think. You've got the acoustic guitars. You've got all of these amazing harmonies, a lot of whom are just David Crosby layering, like you said. And you think, wow, this is a... As just a soundscape, it sounds so clean and fresh and open, and you can hear every single instrument. And if you compare that to a lot of albums at the time, you know, there's a much more of a muddiness to a lot of those records, whereas this just sounds, I don't know what they were doing in the studio, but they've absolutely nailed it, basically.
I thought I met a man who said mistaken only another stranger that I'm.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's also in the mix there, they use, and it's certainly on Laughing, he uses an auto harp, and Traction in the Rain as well is another track where they use that. And it's just a sort of, I know what you mean about those very focused, short, sharp, hip songs. And you'll find plenty of examples of that in 1001 album, not least, you know, Sex Pistols album or the Ramones debut album, you know, for that matter, which kind of is the ultimate in that kind of statement. But this just takes you on a, for me, you have to grow with it, Alan, I think. Yeah, you have to grow with the album. You have to just sit down and let it play over you. And in a sense, again, what makes it interesting to me is it's not just, it is kind of rock music. It is kind of folky. On that Master Tapes interview that I mentioned earlier, which he did, I think it was 2013, he sings a cappella, a few lines from What Are Their Names, which is the fifth track on this album. And he, it sounds just like a folk song. There's no, without the context of any backing, musical backing, it just sounds, the intervals he's singing and the structure of the song just sounds like a folk song, you know. But there's a bit of jazz in here as well. There's a bit of something else that hasn't got a genre name for, we haven't got a genre name for yet in there as well, because you have to give this one time, I think. You just have to let it play over you. It's not going to deliver in, it's not going to deliver in the time it takes you to listen to it the first time.
Got you.
Yeah. And that's, again, part of its magic for me. It reveals itself over time. It's an album that you keep on coming back to, and, you know, obviously that's why I included it in the book.
Well, Robert, you've definitely sold it. If people are listening to this and they're still not willing to go and give it a listen, then I don't know what else you could have said, really, because that's been absolutely brilliant. Thank you so much for your time today. I do really appreciate it. As I say, thank you for the inspiration of the book. It's been a great thing for me, as I just wanted to sort of go on a journey musically, and I'm sure so many other people have kind of used your book. Well, I know they have, because there's probably thousands of blogs out there and YouTube channels and things like that that have done the same. And they, you know, I wonder if what percentage of like Sabu and In the Wee Small Hours and things are because people have done this journey. And I think you've driven a lot of Spotify streams to those early albums, definitely.
Good, yeah. I think it's a bit like, you know, you release, when somebody releases an album, they put it out there in the world, and in a sense, it's out of their hands now. It might become a great album because people think it is, or it might not. It might just die a death, I don't know. But you're not really responsible for that. And if people do pick up on it, it's hugely gratifying. And it's very similar with this book. You put the book out, you don't know what people are going to think of it. And you know people are going to argue about the selection of songs you've made. Mm. But you don't really know if it's going to register, if it's going to mean anything to anybody. And the very fact that you are talking about it today, and you mentioned the other 1001 Albums Club, that going through the book religiously as well. It's immensely heartwarming to feel that it's got this afterlife, and that it's introducing people to music that otherwise they might not have come across. It really is.
Wonderful. All right. Well, where can people find this book? What's the best place for them to get hold of it?
They can, well, online, it's widely available online. You know, I mean, I could name, you know, any, you've got your Waterstones, yeah. You've got your, you can buy it on Amazon, you know, if you are so inclined, you could do that. It's not going to be a problem to buy it on Amazon, certainly. I'm sure they'll do a very quick delivery for you and everything. You know, I personally prefer to try and still support some of the book chains that are out there. So if you've got a local bookshop, I would strongly suggest if you're able to pop down there and ask them to order it, you know, and do something for the local independents. That would be wonderful.
That's a great shout, actually. Yeah, that is a really good shout. Wonderful. All right, well, Rob, thank you so much. It'd be great to have you on again at some point. And and once again, thank you for the inspiration.
Cheers. No problem at all. Take care, James.